we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hello and welcome to the In Tech We Trust podcast. I'm Nigel Poulton.
I'm Mark Farley.
And I'm Dean Porter de Leon.
Cool. So guys, before we get into the tech news this week, Dean, you've got something a little bit scary, maybe to tell us about passwords and where people store them.
Yeah, this was a headline that jumped out at me. It was 40% of organizations store admin passwords in Word documents. Now, that didn't actually surprise me that people do that, I think, but the 40% of worldwide organizations, and now, mind you, this is a sample. This is not a comprehensive survey of all enterprises on the planet Earth, but 750 IT security decision makers, and for those of you who can't see me, I'm using air quotes, they were surveyed and asked where do they store, you know, privileged information. And so, and the two answers they gave back were actually Word docs and spreadsheets, while about 28% used a shared server or a USB stick. Now, my first question when I thought of this, and you guys give me your perspective of, who is answering the survey and saying that they're keeping admin passwords on Word docs and Excel spreadsheets?
Yeah, and why aren't they including post-it notes? Come on. or envelopes. I mean, shit, where do you guys keep your passwords?
I tattoo mine to my, well, we won't go there. You know what, though? I was actually, a hidden location. No, I was actually quite impressed that it was as low as 40%. I honestly would have expected it to be higher than that. I don't know where people expect, you know, people like that to be storing passwords. I know there are things like secure key stores and things like that, but they're just not that widely used. And is it only half the story as well? Because look, I store my passwords in a text file, but I've got my own personal like cipher that I use. So it's not like you can just pick my file up and you've got all of my usernames with the passwords printed in clear text next to them. It's not quite like that. And I'm sure it's probably...
Is it the twisted cipher inside your head?
That's it, yeah. That I can't even decipher myself sometimes.
Is it a cyber inside your head?
Yeah.
Where do you go there? But no,
sorry, I mean, about that. I had to.
This was done by, I think it was a self-serving survey that was done by this company called CyberArk, who basically has a solution that manages stuff like this, like users, passwords, admin passwords, you know, generic, you know, company, you know, administrator IDs and credentials. So this was really their way of really fleshing out this issue. Which it is, and I agree, because we've all seen the sausage being made at IT teams and enterprises across the board, and they all have horribly dysfunctional solutions. I know one major company who I shall remain nameless, and many of them have done this way, but they basically did a refresh of the operating system on, you know, company wide on all these laptops by having like everyone write their like passwords down on post-it notes and sticking them on the laptops and then passing them back and forth between like these high IT help desk teams and same thing with, you know, administrators. I think your point, Mark, post-it notes. I wanted to see that on the survey. What's the percentage of people where their admin passwords are literally stuck on post-it notes, you know, on screens somewhere in the office? And I bet you that would be like probably 15%.
And if not the front side, the back side of the screen.
Yeah.
You have to include that too.
Or they could just be a cipher, a post-it cipher.
Honestly, though, is it really that bad? Look, I know it's not like, you know, the auditors and people like that and shareholders would not be happy, but honestly, boots on the ground, real world, let's put this into perspective. Is it really that bad? It ain't great, I know that, but are we making something more out of this than...
What's the
really
question?
Bad?
Is it really bad to put it in Word documents, or is it bad that this many people are doing it, or what do you mean? What's the scope of bad,
is it,
Nigel?
Okay, so is it really bad to put it in a Word document somewhere? I know it's not great, right, but I just don't think it's the end of the world. I mean, okay, well, we don't know the full story here. They're not necessarily all putting them all in clear text. And
well, if the password is not... If the password is there by itself and it doesn't necessarily show what the password is for, it's okay.
Yeah, right? Passwords without context. And I think somebody was doing a great piece on this, but the password without the context actually isn't that bad. No, it was actually a webinar that I was on. It was an IT security webinar.
Was it a webinar that you did? I mean, were you the main speaker?
That sounds awful.
No, this was actually a good few IT leaders and decision makers from multiple companies were actually talking about the problem wasn't actually that bad when you have a password without the context for that password. The thing is, you get is if and you guys have experienced it. But come on, guys, if a solution is good enough and you haven't run into an issue, that solution gets implemented. And especially with SaaS applications, if you have like 20 different applications that you're consuming as an organization or IT organization that are SaaS apps, and you are admin on all of these, 20 different passwords are going to go put somewhere, and you've got to be able to communicate this to other people who are within the IT team. So you got to put it somewhere that it's shared. And so where do you put it that's shared without consuming another SaaS application and costing you more money when the organization, you know, is already spending money on all these other SaaS applications? And why do you need to? Do you need to? I mean, to your point, Nigel, do you really need to put them somewhere? I mean, it sounds crazy. It sounds nuts. If there's a breach and someone gets the Word doc with a bunch of passwords on it, if it doesn't have the links to the services or SaaS applications where, you know, we're the admin to, is that really bad? But I'd imagine these are probably spreadsheets that have the link, you know, to the login page, the username and the password. And if somebody grabbed that, then yeah, you know, they'd be able to become the admin on, you know, on your eClub account. So everyone's lunch wouldn't get delivered on time.
Actually, Dean, you just said something, right? They're on Word documents. They're not in spreadsheets. That makes it actually even harder to access and use. If they're in spreadsheets, it's pretty easy to line everything up and say password, you know, target. Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Yeah, I think the most secure way is that text and text with ciphers.
Yeah, definitely. And we don't know that they're not doing that. But you know what? Here's the real question in my head, right? It's 2016 right now. Is the day of the password not dead? I mean, all of my, like, my online banking for my phone and stuff, I don't have to put a code in it anymore. It's just my thumbprint. You know, why are we still using passwords like we are at the moment? Surely there's much better ways to do this now.
Well, you know, you're so advanced over there in the UK, I still use passwords here.
Well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the password's not going to go away for a long time, but it definitely needs to change. And everyone, you'll hear blog, if you search online, there'll be a million blog posts on why password, the whole system is broken. And a friend of mine worked at Google, and he was actually in their security team, and he was actually working on the team that was sort of moving, you know, the whole ecosystem away from passwords. And there's a couple interesting pieces, that Google's trying to do, which is context-based. It's like, where are you? You know, what activity have you been doing on the phone? And more than one way to be able to authenticate you. And there's lots of really interesting ideas out there. And I think if you really do a context-based approach to it, then you'd have to map such a wide array of behavior to be able to then authenticate yourself, because you'd be doing a land speed check, plus you'd be doing, you know, usage patterns, plus all these other different things in addition to your thumbprint. And you put all this together, and it's just, you know, it becomes at a certain point once you actually know enough about a person, because, you know, Google knows everything about you.
Oh, yeah.
Nigel, Mark, they know it all. Then it becomes nearly impossible to be able to spoof, you know, an ID for somebody.
But sometimes it becomes too difficult, doesn't it? Because, Mark, when you had your phone robbed off you in London, because you were out of the country and they were trying to send you a verification text message or something, whatever it was actually too complicated to work as well, wasn't it? So we're in
danger. Well, it was dual-factor authentication, and they were sending me the factor to my phone.
Oh yeah, right. Don't you need your phone to activate your phone?
I need my phone to be able to log onto a website to tell them my phone was stolen.
Never mind.
Yeah.
I think we should just do blood smears. Right
there, you go.
You know, just everybody get used to pricking your fingers 50 times a day. Then when we log in, we'll just do a little DNA thing.
No, that's how they did in Gattaca.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I need to see Gattaca.
Oh, yeah. Great.
There's a lot of things I haven't seen. I am like a newbie.
Yeah. Hot tub time machine number 2. It's high up on the list, Mark. I'm just saying.
Did they do that in there, too?
No, there's only single factor authentication. Hot tub.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So should we say what else we've got then?
Yeah, we're not going to do any banter then. I guess we just did it.
Yeah, that was plenty of banter.
We've got a few things on the agenda, right? So what the heck? Cisco blaming a bug on cosmic rays. I really want to get into that one. Yeah, I know. Microsoft and Adobe are cozying up together in the Azure cloud. Google, I like this one as well. I really want to talk about this one. They have got big enough and hairy enough nuts to go where a Kami wouldn't dare to go. Windows Server 2016.
Don't you call that Akamai?
Akamai? Yeah, maybe you do in the States. You guys can't speak, though.
You speak the Akamai.
We'll interpret everybody. That was Akamai, not...
Yeah. So what did I say?
What did you even call it, Nigel?
Akamai?
Akami.
Akami? Yeah, it's like Azure, right?
You probably see Adidas, too.
Yeah,
well, you got Azure right. You didn't say Azure.
The thing is, in today's like multilingual, multicultural world, if you choose a company name like that that's got any kind of potential for screwing up the pronunciation like that, you deserve everything you get in my book.
Like Adobe.
Yeah. Anyway, so at the MS Ignite conference... Windows Server 2016 was announced as general availability, I think, maybe from the 1st of October or something.
Mark's pouring a beer.
Yeah. And interestingly, apparently Disney are interested in buying Twitter. So
Disney
let's
and everybody
see if we
else.
Cover them all, right? Well, I know, yeah. And I don't
I think
know
they should do a merger and call it Twitter.
Oh.
Oh, that's bad.
We've been waiting all day to say that, haven't you?
Distant, how about how about Twitney?
Yeah, hey now.
Right, oh, so let's hit this Cisco one, right? So there's Cisco have blamed some kind of memory bit flipping error in a router, not on bad code, but on cosmic rays. Now, I don't know if it was a tongue-in-cheek thing, right? But I just love the whole idea that potentially cosmic rays... As we kind of like shrink the geometries of everything we do with chips and fabs and things like that, right, shrinking geometries, it apparently becomes more and more likely and easier for things like cosmic rays to cause bit flips and things like that. So it makes me wonder, right, are we getting to the point where we're so reliant on technology that like some kind of solar flare and... I think the technical term is coronal mass ejection. Careful how you say that. They call it a CME.
CME.
If you inject that into any technology, you'll have problems.
Hey now, yeah. So anyway, apparently things like that are going to be able to wreak havoc across electrical systems and communication systems in the planet in the future. So should we be designing and building core infrastructures to be like shielded from cosmic rays? Can you even do that?
I don't think you can even do it.
Cosmic ray shielding. I think it's an upgrade now for most mobile phones. But, I mean, with cell phone communication, yes, so powerful enough solar flares will be able to, you know, cause issues with, you know, with connectivity. But I think that's just wireless, you know, over-the-air communication. So, I mean, this was on a router. This was on a physical box.
Yeah, this is physical stuff. And I believe it flipped a bit in a memory module on a line card. Don't quote me on that, right? But this is like proper, like, I don't know, traditional hardware in a data center somewhere. So I'm like, you know, do we need to be building either, shielded chassis, or do we need to shield our data centers, or do we need to, like, build them under the ground or under the ocean or something?
If you just wrap the data center in tinfoil, you'll be fine.
Oh, that's
it. I don't think you can shield this stuff from these subatomic particles, right, that come in and do this stuff. I mean, this is part of the bit rot story from storage going way back, that sooner or later something's going to get whacked on a disk drive and a bit's going to flip, and it's why you have redundancy. It's why you have error checking. I mean, this is not new. I mean, you know, cosmic rays aren't new, and flipping bits aren't new. I kind of like, really, Cisco? You know, you don't have any redundancy built in to check for this. There's no data checking. You know, how did this happen? Where was it injected? What did you do? Was it in the control path or the data path? Does anybody know what the hell this thing was?
No, I don't. And maybe I should, since I think I suggested the story. But I like your idea there, Mark, actually. Rather than take the approach that I was thinking there of, like, building some Uber shielding, let's just have, like, let's have better kind of error checking and error correction and stuff built in at the low level like that, that's constantly scrubbing and checking and make sure we don't. I mean, look, things like that usually are easier said than done, right? Especially if these things are high performance and operating at real time and what have you.
But way easier said than done, but that's why disk storage systems have been doing background scrubbing for years,
yeah,
decades. I mean, shit, this stuff happens all the time to disk drives. It's why the error rates are what they are for the drives.
Totally. Hey, do you think it's a bit cheap or a bit cheeky, at least, of Cisco to say that, you know, maybe a cosmic ray caused this? Because, I mean, how would you ever even know that?
I was just about to ask. Is there like a cosmic ray detection, like, you know, like a smoke detector, except it's a cosmic ray detector? And it says, oh, cosmic rays hit. And here I see right here on the logs, which is funny because actually they print the logs on the in the trouble report or the issue report. You can see the logs from the frames that were dropped. And I don't see anything in the logs right now that were coinciding with the cosmic rays. The logs should include that. See, that's just bad logging.
Yeah. What, cosmic so you've ray. Scraped the logs, yeah, and there's no, like, you've grepped it for cosmic ray and you didn't find anything.
Oh, yeah. It says drop frame CRC error cosmic. It should say cosmic there, but it doesn't. It just says something else.
I think we should start blaming cosmic rays on state nations. You know, it was a Chinese cosmic ray. It was a Russian cosmic ray. Yeah. Was it a CCR or was it an RCR? Yeah. I mean, what the hell was it?
Oh, better than that, Mark. I think anytime we have a problem with a podcast, we should blame it on cosmic rays.
Or a nation state.
Or a nation
state. Or both.
Or a cosmic ray coming from a nation state cosmic ray gun.
Yeah. It could have been Lithuania. We don't know.
It could have been, yeah. All right, then. So I think we've flogged that one.
In other news, a flawless and wonderful transition I like to use in podcasting, Microsoft just signed up Adobe for its Azure Cloud Computing Service. And now, at first blush, you're like, okay, Adobe, that makes sense. And some people have actually been saying this to me, like, well, where's Adobe? Adobe actually has been reporting some phenomenal quarterly results. Just their most recent quarter was actually really good. Adobe's doing some amazing stuff, and it's been really impressive how well they've been able to execute. And so they're a very, very relevant company. And now they're moving to the cloud in a big way. But interesting point on this one. So Microsoft signs up Adobe for Azure Cloud. But if you go onto any AWS like webinar, you'll notice that they're all run by Adobe Connect. And I think that's interesting that that what's running, like, all the, you know, and Adobe Connect is, you know, a video, you know, webinar sort of chat, you know, basically kind of go-to meeting platform. Really slick, really nice. You can do a lot of stuff with it. But I think it's interesting that, you know, Microsoft making this announcement when Adobe runs a huge workload, I mean, video and image and webinars, you know, on AWS. And AWS actually issued a statement where they said that they've got a long-term relationship with Adobe and nothing's going to change and people that want to use AWS are still going to be able to use it. But, I mean, don't you guys think that's straining that relationship a little bit? Because Microsoft is now saying that, you know, Adobe is their preferred marketing service, preferred marketing services for Microsoft's Dynamic, you know, 365 Enterprise CRM. You know, they're going to be delivering its cloud service. You know, Adobe's going to be delivering its cloud service on Microsoft Azure. I mean, what does this say with, you know, for AWS? Do you feel like it's a loss, like, for AWS? Are we going to start seeing, you know, winners and losers and people starting to move away from AWS and move over to Azure?
It's only a loss if it's an exclusive deal with Microsoft. Right, between Adobe and Microsoft, whereas I think the deal with AWS is with Adobe.
Yes, it's with Adobe. Yeah. Adobe and Azure are making a partnership.
So it's interesting, right? Did you guys happen to look at the Adobe Marketing Cloud stuff?
No.
I did. No. I did. And I was shocked, blown away. It's like, okay, so where's all this money coming in from Adobe? You know, it can't be PDFs. And is it really, you know, video production, audio production? Holy shit, Adobe has this enormous, very sophisticated marketing service.
Yeah.
And, you know, shame on me for not recognizing it. So I have it up on my screen right now, the Adobe Marketing Cloud. And this is the deal that Adobe is bringing to, what not Office 365, what is it, Dynamics 365?
Dynamics 365.
Dynamics 365, the ability to...
CRM solution.
Yeah, CRM, the ability to integrate this in with it. And this is an incredibly sophisticated marketing platform. I'm just blown away. You know, so I'll read these things off to you. Analytics, audience manager, campaign, experience manager, which is how you feed content to people, media optimizer, how do you make media buys, prime time, I don't know what that is, social and target. And
wait a minute, Mark, we need all of that for the podcast. You're the expert now because you've actually clapped your eyes on it.
Okay, Nigel, thanks for speaking up. You got campaign.
Yeah.
you own campaign, Nigel.
Yeah.
I mean, the Adobe has really been doing a lot of work. My guess is what happened here is Adobe had developed all of these things for their own internal business, just kind of like AWS developed, you know, all of their own infrastructure to support, you know, buying and selling, and then decided, well, we'll sell infrastructure as a service. Adobe's been developing this marketing stuff, and now they're making this marketing cloud as a service, and they're putting it in on Azure, and they're integrating it with Dynamics 365. What'll be interesting is whether or not this is an exclusive deal with Microsoft, a time-based deal or something like that. And I don't know that Microsoft would enter into it if it were not.
It says they're preferred. It didn't say exclusive. It said preferred. But I'm glad you brought up a lot of the details on Adobe. Like I was saying, I mean, this company is executing tremendously. I mean, they just reported last quarter their revenue $1.5 billion. I mean, did anyone think that, you know, that Adobe was like a $6 billion a year company? Did anyone imagine that?
I did know that they're going places because I have their Creative Cloud Suite. So like all of their creative products, and I pay them £45 a month for the pleasure or for the privilege of that. Mm. And they are great products. And I know that that kind of subscription-based model for them has got to be an absolute money raker for them. Oh, yeah. Because the way they've got it set up is you can buy one of the products from the Creative Cloud Suite for something like, I don't know, it's like £15 a month, or you can have them all for £45, and there's nothing in between. Now, I only needed two, so I have to go for them all at £45, and I bet a lot of people do that, and I think they're raking the cash in over that. So of that $1.5 billion, or of the, you know, the overall revenue that the company does, do we have a feel at all for how much of that is through the marketing side of the business or not?
I didn't break down the corner. I'm looking at their quarterly earnings report, though, right now.
You are our breakdown guy, Yadin.
I know, but subscriptions, you know, the subscriptions are going through the roof. I mean, like the subscriptions is going like, I mean, it's growing like 300% based on, you know, on wow. their revenue reports. So I think that's a huge growth vector right there.
I should look for a job there. Do they have room for a brewmeister? That's what I'm looking
for. Look for a brewmeister. I'm sure they do local, but yeah, I mean, the subscription services just looks huge from, you know, year over year perspective.
Getting back to the question as well as to whether or not AWS should be concerned about this, you know, I think we're going to be expecting going forward, aren't we, that just about every company out there is going to look to leverage more than one cloud platform. And I think at the infrastructure level, which we're not talking about here, I appreciate that, but at like the infrastructure as a service level, people are going to be looking to, in the future, balance their environments across multiple cloud providers. Then when it comes to things that are like higher up, you know, platform as a service and all those kinds of things, people are just going to start picking the best, I think. And we should expect to see people jumping between clouds and having certain business units running on one cloud and other business units within the same organization leveraging another cloud. I don't see that as being a problem. I think that's
Nigel, you're going on way too long. You're taking this way too long, Nigel. You asked the question, should AWS be worried about this? And the answer is they should be more worried about this than they are about Oracle.
Oh, but they don't even know Dark Horse exists, cloud. Right?
I mean, because realistically, this is a sophisticated deal. And this is a more sophisticated type of service. And if Microsoft is able to get marketers everywhere to buy into Dynamics 365, Oracle and AWS should both worry about this. This is a great move for both these companies. And if Microsoft can become the de facto standard now for marketing services, customer, you know, ERP services. Holy shit!
Yeah,
and that's where they're going, right? I mean, Microsoft's very savvy, and so they do this deal. If this really works out for them, both Oracle and Amazon could have a lot to lose.
And Microsoft, like you're saying, there huge amount to gain there as well. They're doing it. They're turning it on. Really turning the screw there with the Azure cloud. I think at the moment, all I hear is positive stuff coming out in the press about that business unit.
Yeah, so, you know, Amazon has a number of different services. A lot of them are infrastructure as a service. This is a software as a service deal. And it's like, okay, so if you need to get something done, come to Azure Cloud and we'll get this done. And integrating the Adobe Marketing Cloud is a really cool thing instead of just like, well, you know, we'll set up servers for you and install the stuff on those and roll your own, right?
Do you think it's fair to say that those kind of services are harder to commoditize than infrastructure as well? I think my gut feel would be that they are, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, for one, I think the pricing is going to be interesting on it, how Adobe and Microsoft share the revenue for this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's a different story. But, you know, if you're looking for a turnkey solution and, you know, you're a marketing person, you know, it's like, well, do I really want to do anything on Amazon? I'm going to scratch my head. Do I want to do this with Oracle? Is it on the cloud? Is it not? Which cloud is it? You know, and they look at, oh, Dynamics 365 and Adobe Marketing Cloud. Bingo, done. I think this is a big deal.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. One of the points that you brought up earlier was like, Nigel, which is, are people just going to be choosing the best? And I think the niche products on the platforms that solve the business case the most are going to be chosen. And it's just not going to be like AWS or Microsoft. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like this one solution that solves a niche problem in a better way than any other, you know, ISV can do it or any other service integrator can do it on AWS. That's what's going to win.
And that's where the value is going to be for these cloud providers, I think, as well, isn't it? As infrastructure as a service gets more and more commoditized and there's, you know, a race to the bottom for pricing there as well. If you're like a clear leader in one of these more niche markets, then I don't know, you can demand a lot more price wise, better margins.
So speaking of Microsoft, Nigel, I know that you're excited about some of the new capabilities that Microsoft is coming out for container support. You want to drill down into that a little more for us?
Yeah, so it's Microsoft Ignite in Atlanta this week. And one of the big stories coming out of there is that the general availability of Windows Server 2016 has finally been announced. And it seems like the only thing that people really are talking about there is containers, okay? Which I think is like, obviously, where my focus is, that's great. It opens up the container ecosystem to, you know, well, just the huge install base of Windows platforms out there, all the millions of .NET developers and what have you. But I think the two things that I'm quite interested in here are, one, how strategic is Windows Server 2016 when we're talking there about Azure and about services and things like that? But then the second question is, why are Microsoft still pushing Windows Server platform so hard when, you know, albeit it's early days, right, but you can get .NET Core on Linux and things like that. And, like, I don't know, why still focus so hard on Windows Server 2016 and make such a big deal about it when you've got so many other cool things going on? So let me just throw the question out there, right? First of all, is Windows Server still a big thing for Microsoft when you compare it to Azure? And is it going to dwindle in the future, or is it still going to be going strong?
Whoa.
You know, I think that's an excellent question. But when I think about this and the way that you frame it up, I'm thinking about reducing friction because, and we've talked about this before with the Microsoft ecosystem, and there's a whole lot of skill sets and a whole lot of organizational momentum with these Microsoft shops and moving in that direction. And a lot of people have changed. People have been agile. People have moved into other solutions and brought those in-house. But are we looking at, and this is almost answering a question with another question, are we looking at Microsoft making this easier for people to develop, you know, an application within containers on a Microsoft platform in order for them to easily be able to move it to the cloud one day, so they don't want people developing container applications on Linux, they're getting used to that, and then never ever wanting to go to Azure Cloud at all. Is that, and that might just be one of the reasons, one of the bullet points on this.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, right? Because the Azure Container Service currently only works with Linux, or is only supported with Linux. It's not actually supported with Windows Server. Azure itself, as a cloud infrastructure platform, right, has been all over Linux. And it's, you know, it's own container services built around Linux. So I'm getting mixed messages here that, you know, that they're putting so much into Linux and they're putting so much into Windows. And I don't know why, are they hedging their bets or what? Because, you know, you've released .NET Core for Linux. And look, 99% of .NET stuff doesn't yet work on that. I appreciate that. It's really early days, but you've put it out there as like a, well, what I saw is a strategic move towards Microsoft embracing Linux even more than it has done in the past. Yet there's still so much like excitement around Windows Server. It's certainly not dead, that's for sure.
Yeah, so here's the way I break it down, right? Microsoft has this traditional business. They've got everything built around .NET. They've got all these customers that are using it. They want to maintain that. They want to keep that going. But at the same time, if there's new things going on that they can catch in on that aren't going to, you know, people aren't going to be developing for .NET, they have to be able to go there too. They have to be able to do both, right? Greenfield, new stuff on Linux, they need to play in that, absolutely. And their install base, they need to keep doing that. And it's not a case of, you know, Satya Nadella is a really smart guy here. It's like, why do we want to close the door on all kinds of new great stuff that's going on when we can participate that? And let's keep the old stuff going too. I mean, that's really what being a cloud-first company is. It's not a Windows-first company. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, what does cloud first mean? It means not Windows first. It doesn't mean that Windows is excluded. It doesn't mean that Windows is brought along, but it means that the priority there is the cloud business.
Right.
And so, Windows Server 2016 is a whole new different bag, right? That's a different thing. I mean, Windows Server is a product that was flattening, and Microsoft is very concerned that product was just going to die out and become irrelevant. So they need to make it thin. They need to make it easier for people to develop for. And you know, they've been doing that. You know, Windows Server is going to go from this big bloated thing to this thing that's got, you know, a bunch of tools that people can develop with. And it will, you know, and certain number of developers will find it very cool and want to use it. Other developers will say, shit, you know, I'm going OpenStack, I'm going Linux. Microsoft wants both of those in the cloud.
And if you can have both, why not, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I would guess, right, it's easier to build like an attractive and a pervasive cloud for Linux and for, you know, the modern cloud-first developers, right? And then mop up your existing enterprise customers. It's easier for Microsoft to do that than it is for somebody like Google or Amazon Web Services to get their claws into the enterprise and steal some of those legacy customers. I mean, look, I'm a big fan of Amazon Web Services. I use it every day myself. Love it. Great platform, okay. But I just can't give enough love to what I'm seeing coming out of Azure these days. It's like, got such a great focus, and they seem to be executing so well. I almost want to give them a round of applause. I won't, but
yeah. Well, obviously, it's not just Satya. There's other people there, but Microsoft is really figuring this out, and he's providing the leadership to do it. You know, hats off to this guy. He has transformed that company in, you know, a few short years, and you know, this is so far removed from Ballmer's leadership. It's not funny.
Yeah, and let me ask you a question, Mark, from that perspective. And this is what my thought process was when I was looking at all these changes from open source contributors to the .NET thing to the 2016, you know, server release. And was there a lot of these people that were in the Microsoft ecosystem? They were part of the organization. They were employees of Microsoft. And Satya's just figured out how to get all of these barriers out of their way. Was that talent already pent up in the organization? Now it's kind of just being let loose and getting to be creative, or is there a lot of turnover that created this? Because that usually is a leader. It's one of your primary things is just to enable the people that are working through your organization and getting things out of their way.
Yeah. I think if you look at Microsoft as a company full of developers, there was a lot of pent up stuff there. There was a lot of great ideas, and Satya is just like sort of opening the gates and helping to direct it. And he's got great lieutenants there. Right. I mean, the people that are close to Satya in Microsoft, I think, is a fairly large number, actually, you know, that the organization is somewhat flat in that, you know, he sees a lot of people. And when that leadership groups gets together, it's like 50, 60 people or whatever in a room. Right. It's a lot of people, and a lot of them represent developers. And it's like, this is the way development is going. This is what developers want to do. This is the way we want to work. And it's like, holy cow. You know, and I think that is coming through in a big way.
Power to the developers.
Developers, developers, developers.
I think that's what he has done. I think he's given power to the developers inside Microsoft, and they're cooking.
You're supposed to jump in there, Nigel.
Yeah. Do you think Oracle are looking on and are jealous?
I think Oracle has no idea what kind of muscle Microsoft has.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't say all this ridiculous shit about the cloud. You know, I mean, they have to do something, right? The guys at Oracle, they know they have to do something. I just think that you got a redshift going on, you know, where Amazon and Microsoft are running away. and Google also. I we'll see whether or not Oracle can keep up, but I don't think they've invested nearly enough.
No, they can't. Anyway, never mind.
I mean, I don't see them being the same kind of development organization anyway, right? I just don't see I might be wrong, but I don't think Oracle has the culture of, software developers that just want to make software and do this stuff, right? Unlike, Microsoft. Microsoft has this long culture, just software guys just want to do stuff, right? They just want to create things. And I think where Satya made a distinction when he came in, and he did cut people. There's people that wanted to defend the old Windows way of doing things. He took a hatchet to that.
And it's reaping the benefits right now. Hell yeah. Okay, so let's switch gears just a little bit here. Mark, you've got a story about Disney and Twitter, something like that. Do you want to give us a rundown?
Yeah, the hot rumor all of a sudden is that Disney is lining up to buy Twitter. That Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, and Jack Dorsey at Twitter are in a real bromance. Jack Dorsey's on the board at Disney. And Sheryl Sandberg is also from Facebook. And that Disney badly wants to get into the online stuff somehow. I don't know if you call it business or what, but Disney knows that as a media company, they're basically boxed out of anything interesting online today. And so they really want something relevant. I see it as having a high probability of going through, right? Twitter's in bad shape. They're not getting the user growth that they need, but Disney is a company that badly needs something online. So that's the analysis that I'm hearing, with the players, Bob and Jack and Sheryl, and there you go. What do you guys think?
Well, I think one of the interesting properties that Disney had where there's two pieces actually to this. One is ESPN, and there's a whole bunch of other people that are trying to buy Twitter as well, and I think we'll get to them in a second. But just since we're on Disney, ESPN is a really interesting property, and while the business of ESPN is struggling a little bit, people are not going to stop watching sports.
Hell
and
no.
Twitter is this live platform, and Jack said a bunch of time, it's really about live events. It's about events. And ESPN has millions and millions of viewers who want to engage with this content but don't really have that kind of frictionless. I mean, they can get on Facebook and Twitter, and I have people all the time. I don't know how many weekends where my Facebook and Twitter feed has been filled up with people making comments on whatever 49ers or Raiders game that's going on without any context whatsoever. I just get this yay exclamation mark and like, thanks. I'm not watching the game. but if you were, let's say, through something like a Twitter channels, could have our Twitter ESPN or there could be a bunch of channels within Twitter, and you could be on the ESPN channel watching this, you could be watching Arsenal, or you could be watching, the 49ers. It doesn't matter. And you could be engaging in real time through the platform. And if you combine Periscope, Twitter's, instant messaging plus, a Disney media company, you could have a winning combination. And in addition, a lot of people don't know this, but there's a whole service that Twitter has, which is Buy Now, which is an integration for merchandising. And so you've got merchandising, whether it's through the ESPN or through just, of course, Disney's massive retail engine that is coupled with its entertainment company. I think you could have a powerful combination there.
But you do.
But Disney is just one of many.
You said you see it as a winning combination, right? But surely a winning combination is a combination that has some kind of profit-making long-term business plan. And I see none of that from Twitter. I get that it's a great platform to engage in real time, kind of what's going down and the integration with sports and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, Disney is a profit-making company, and it needs to be able to, an acquisition like that, they wouldn't get them for cheap. There's a lot of infrastructure to run it, to keep it up and running. Where's the money going to come from? How is it not just going to be a black hole? I don't see it. Yeah.
I think, Nigel, if you look at something like Twitter as being an advertising channel for Disney content, it doesn't have to generate money itself as long as it helps bring attention to all this other content that Disney wants to provide, right? Disney needs a channel, they need both an advertising channel, an awareness generating channel, and also a channel to present stuff. And they want to figure out how to present not just, full length motion pictures and animations, but all kinds of little things, right? Pixar makes a 3-minute video. Well, how does anybody see that? What if it's on Twitter, right? All of a sudden they can do that. And Disney doesn't have another way of doing that.
Just to respond to you, Mark, with regards to where the money's going to come from, Disney is and approaching this from two sides. One is how's the business going to win, and how is the consumer of the business, i.e. the product, which is, you know, you and me and everyone else, you know, in tech who's on Twitter, who's going to win in this? Disney can figure out how to monetize Twitter in a way that Twitter can't, with coupling the two companies. And that's what's the struggle. The struggle has been is that Twitter has struggled to keep up with the likes of Google and Facebook with advertising. So Disney can more than, you know, find a way to monetize this. But who wins out in this? Is Twitter win out? Yes, Twitter wins out during the acquisition. A lot of people get an exit for the, you know, or get a bump in their stock, which they've already done. It's gone up 20%. But if it's also gone on down 20% in the last year, and this is the only thing that's propped up the stock, is this rumor that there's going to be this acquisition. But I don't know if the users of Twitter are going to benefit from this. I mean, when you get a company who's really going to be able to figure out how to monetize Twitter really well, you're not going to have the same user experience that you've got right now with
hell no.
So it's going to be, there's going to be buy now links everywhere. There's going to be a lot more hooks into even private things like lists. If you've got a list, you know, instead of just looking at, you know, at your feed, you're going to get more and more sponsored content, native advertising, retail hooks, and that's just an inevitability. And so what do you want the future of Twitter to look like? And that's really the question that you're looking at. So who do I want my future Twitter to be? Do I want it to be a Disney Twitter, or do I want to be a Google Twitter? Do you want to be a Microsoft Twitter? I mean, there's a lot of names that are getting thrown out for potential buyers here, as far as who's going to be the better. And if you really want to, get Twitter, into some place where you're going to be able to monetize it really well, I can't see anyone being better than Google from the list of people who are potentially going to buy this, being better at monetizing with search within the Twitter platform, except for that little thing like that's called social that they haven't quite been able to get yet. You guys, what are your thoughts about Google and what they would do with Twitter?
You know, that's an interesting thing. What Google would do with Twitter, they would maybe shoot Google Plus. I mean, maybe the first thing to do would they shoot Google Plus.
The right thing.
I mean, yeah. If you've got Twitter, who needs Google Plus? That's got to be something of a failure for Google. I mean, the interesting thing, though, is all of the real downside of Twitter, all of the bullying, you know, the hiding behind stuff. I mean, the really awful behavior that goes on Twitter.
They still can't control it. It's still a huge problem.
Disney has to control that.
Yeah, they do.
Right? Disney is the family, you know, media entertainment company. And I know they want to be something beyond just, you know, like the family entertainment company. But can you imagine all of the shitstorm that goes on Twitter if it's on like a Disney property? I mean, that is something that they would stop immediately, and that would change the culture on Twitter.
Yeah, that's an interesting spin.
Yeah, there would be things that they would have to do that would change sort of the way, you know, the free speech that you got on Twitter today.
One of the names that surprised me was Verizon. So Verizon could become a digital advertising challenger to Google. I'm sorry, that's you guys give me your opinions on this, but I don't see Verizon being a digital advertising challenger to anyone.
No, I don't see that either. No.
Yeah, I haven't heard them yet. I mean, it's interesting. What's Verizon up to, right? Verizon's got a bunch of digital initiatives going on where they're trying to figure out content. They're trying to figure out streaming content. They look at Netflix and they say, oh, geez, Netflix did content. Maybe we didn't need to do content. I mean, what is Verizon's path as a network provider? Is it a big deal? Is it a small deal? Do they fade off in the sunset? Do they need other shit? I mean, if Verizon's looking at this, you know, is AT&T looking at it then too? Or is AT&T just happy to be a network operator?
I don't know. I can't see Verizon doing this after, you know, committing to buy Yahoo. And so taking on a struggling tech company, you know, and with
that deal is not done.
You know, Yahoo already,
by the way, that deal's not done. And so, you know, like the recent Yahoo hacks that just happened, right? All these Yahoo accounts get hacked. You know, the thing that's interesting about it is, well, that shit is on Yahoo, and it's not necessarily, Verizon doesn't necessarily want to own that.
Yeah, that doesn't look good on the on a mergers and acquisition resume.
It does not. Yeah, we just bought like one of the biggest hacks in history, and you know, oh my God.
Yeah, and it happened like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that deal might not go through. it probably will, but
yeah,
I just know that's one of the things that's going on with it.
Yeah, but I mean, with a price tag that people are throwing out, $30 billion price tag for Twitter, I just don't see how Verizon swings that.
Yeah, with debt, right? I mean, that's the deal with Disney, yeah, too, right? How is Disney going to do it? They got like $6 billion of cash on hand or something like that. They're really going to take on that much debt to get Twitter? And to Nigel's point, Twitter doesn't generate any revenue. That means that thing better be really freaking good at churning interest in your content.
Isn't it crazy, though, that you can have $6 billion on hand in cash and it just amounts to nothing these days for a major acquisition, right? I mean, Twitter's not even making money and they're throwing ludicrous numbers like that out there. Oh.
$6 billion, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come, exactly. Come back when you've got some real money.
Says Jack Dorsey, you know, mm-hmm, who happens to be on Disney's board. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to look at something weird. I mean, if Disney buys Twitter, what kind of lawsuits do you think will show up because Jack Dorsey happens to be on Disney's board?
That's interesting. But you know, one of the funniest stories that reminds me of, I just remember this, wasn't like years ago, didn't Zuckerberg meet with Jack and the gang and talking about buying Twitter way back in the day? And he comes to them, or comes to Zuckerberg, and he said, and Zuckerberg's like, because they're driving down, this is a great story, I think Jack tells it. They're driving down, you know, down the peninsula, you know, in the car, and they're like, what should we say we want to sell this for? And they get in with Mark, and they say, like, we want $500 million. And it's basically, they didn't really have much back then. And then, and Mark's like, that's a lot of money. No. I'm not sure that meeting would go the same way.
Yeah.
If they had it.
Well, and it is interesting thinking about these boardroom discussions, if this is going on at Disney with Sheryl Sandberg there from Facebook, because that would turn Disney into more of a competitor with Facebook. There's no question. If Disney has Twitter, that competes with Facebook, and Disney would be trying to do similar things. There would be certainly overlap between Disney Twitter.
Yeah.
Twitter. What would we call it? Dister? Yeah.
Twitney.
Twitney. Yeah. There would be overlap between Twitney and Facebook.
But what about Microsoft? That's another name that's getting thrown out there.
Microsoft buying Twitter?
And they just bought LinkedIn.
I know, they don't.
And people are saying that Microsoft's thrown out some bid.
I would say they could afford to at least, though. How much did they pay for LinkedIn? Was that $12
billion? $26
billion. Oh, good grief, right?
Yeah.
I think it's $26 billion, and I mean, I guess they would have to fess up that Yammer is a piece of shit.
But even Microsoft, right? Surely they couldn't just swallow $56 billion worth of acquisitions in 1 year. Well, I guess they could. I mean, Dell have managed to finance the EMC deal to the tune of $56 billion, wasn't it? And that was all debt. Yeah, maybe Microsoft could afford them.
Yeah, I think people that want to loan money are looking for anything they can loan money to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money on the sidelines. People think that there's some bubble, but there's a ton of money still on the sidelines from investors that want to put it to work. So if there's a will, there's a way, a.k.a. there's money. You know what I want to throw out there? I want to throw out a rumor. There's not even a rumor yet. I want to throw out Amazon buying Twitter.
Because
with the purchasing integration as a platform, and Amazon can pretty much sell anything, and they're phenomenal at selling things like through their Kindle and through their web portal, but they tried to have a mobile phone, but they couldn't quite get it. If they got Twitter, they would be on the mobile phone and they'd be able to put hooks into Twitter that would and they could monetize the hell out of it. I think Amazon buying Twitter as a retail platform makes more sense than a lot of other these rumored.
You deem you're a genius.
Yeah, I like it.
And then all
it.
The bad behavior on Twitter could stick around because Amazon doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. Oh, they don't. There's a ton of bad behavior on Amazon. Yeah. Have you tried to buy stuff on Amazon Marketplace, man? There's just a ton of phony stuff and hacks and.
You want to behave badly on Twitter? Like, cheer for Amazon to buy.
Yeah. Bezos will be fine with that. And that's his social. That's his mobile strategy. Yeah. That would be a good hook in it. So Bezos, that one's free. I won't charge you anything for consulting for
so
that.
So is that how you pronounce his surname? I thought it was Jeff Bezos. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
We don't speak the Queen's English over here. We speak American.
Hey,
which gets us back to this whole deal with Akamai.
Speaking
of mispronunciation, so what was that deal about, Nigel?
Okay, so there was, we won't spend a lot of time on it, I guess, but there was a website out there, I can't even remember its name now, but it calls out a lot of these like online gangs that do DDoS attacks and things like that. And because it's out there kind of on its own, shining a light on the bad guys tend to attack it a lot. So it had some kind of DDoS protection service from
Akamai.
From Akamai, right? But apparently one of the most recent DDoS attacks against this security website was so intense that Akamai just decided, hell, look, it's about to take us under and all of our other customers. So they just cut this site loose and said, you're paying for protection from us, but actually we're not big enough and tough enough to protect you from an attack of this size. So it cut them loose, left them on their own. But then Google came sailing to the rescue and said, well, you know, we've got this Shield service or whatever it is, and we'll protect you from the bad guys. Which, look, I just thought was an interesting story in that Google quite often gets a lot of bad press saying that they're the evil company and what have you at the moment. But they've got the infrastructure, they've got the services, they've got the capability to stand up against most bad guys and say, we'll protect you, and you know, continue on with your mission of exposing the bad guys. And we're on your side, which I thought was like a, I don't know, just like a nice story.
It's a great story. It's a great white hat story. I love Google to death for this. It's awesome. So this guy Krebs.
Yeah,
but
that's
is it
right.
Brian Krebs? I mean, he exposes. He puts out names of people that he believes are making these attacks. And so he gets attacked a lot.
Yeah.
He's trying to expose them, right? He's a guy that says, here's the people making all the bad moves. And he puts their names right out there and he gets attacked. And he got super attacked. And Google came in to protect him.
And
freaking A.
And
great Akamai Google.
Weren't able to protect him either, even though he was paying for service from them to do that. It's kind of like, yeah, well done, Google. I like that. So anyway, we won't spend time on it. We're running a bit long. So, Mark, you wanted to talk about one thing that you saw on Reddit earlier this week. We might make this kind of thing regular thing on the podcast, probably not every week, but if we scour Reddit and we find interesting conversations that we feel like we can weigh in on, maybe we will in the future. Mark, do you want to give us a rundown of what you've got?
Yeah, so I saw this thing on Reddit where somebody was considering building their own SSD storage to handle their email system, which was built on Karyo Connect. For those of you that don't know Karyo Connect, it's both available as a web service as well as a software that you can install. They have about 425 users in this site, and the administrator's looking at having IOPS that exceed what he can get out of his current disk-based storage. And so the question he's asking is, do I want to, you know, build my own SSD-based storage, or should I, you know, increase the number of disk drives? Let's see. I'm trying to think. If anybody really wants to know, this is the title of it. Move to SSD or add more HDD for IOPS intensive mail server. Right? That's the title. Move to SSD or add more HDD for IOPS intensive mail server. And we should put this in the show notes.
Yeah.
And so he's like trying to figure this out, what he wants to do. And, you know, 425 people, it's not a database based email system. It's flat files. And he says there's a lot of writes every time a mail operation is done. So it's pretty write intensive. And he's afraid of what will happen with especially consumer grade SSDs with write wear out because there's so many writes going on. So he's got up. There's like 25 comments as of today, and people are weighing in on it one way or another. And I just thought it would be interesting to talk about because we should try to give this guy advice in one way or another, even though we're not on Reddit.
So here's my advice, right? If he's the guy that's in charge of it, now I don't understand the politics of his organization or anything like that, right? But if he goes out on a limb and it's his idea to homebrew something, right, on consumer-grade SSDs, which I personally wouldn't recommend he does, right, and it goes tits up, he is in the firing line there. Now, that's not necessarily technical, okay? I'm talking politics here, right? If you put your hand up and you say, I'm going to build something funky myself and I'm going to, you know, go away from vendor recommendations or anything like that, you better have big old nuts to be able to handle yourself politically, right? Because... Yeah. It was your idea, right? And if it fails, the fingers are all going to be pointing at you. So I think, you know, if he's asking the question, do I do something DIY with consumer-grade SSDs, negative on that.
I can't agree with you more, Nigel. Why would you do this yourself, right? Now, the array manufacturers are using consumer-grade SSDs, multi-level SSDs, but they are working with the same firmware level. They're working with the same manufacturer. They're working out the bugs. And I know guys think that we can just build it ourselves from product that we buy from a distributor. It's not the same. You don't have the same kind of engineering behind it. You have not diagnosed problems and gone through that with the manufacturer before you put that product in the market. My advice would be very strongly to buy a product from a company and use it, right? And you might say, well, I've been okay building my own disk drive systems. Well, maybe yes, maybe no, but I would not do it with the consumer-grade SSDs. A lot of people have given them that advice. There's plenty of good alternatives and ways to buy products less expensively, certainly than list price, that will give you the, you know, you want warranty protection, you want replacement protection, you know, you want that kind of support, I believe, for the lifeblood of your company. You're better off buying that and getting some guarantee than building yourself and having your head get cut off because, oops, email just failed for the third time this week.
Email is like a business critical service these days, right? I think every single disaster recovery planning session I've been in the last at least 5 years, right? Maybe 7, 8, 9 years. One of the first systems that the business wants bringing up, and IT as well, is email. It's like it's absolutely critical. It's not like it's some nice to have service, right? You want to be building that on something rock solid in my books.
Yeah, so I mean, from my perspective, both Dell and HPE are selling systems at, if you will, this low end, this SMB space, and they're not that expensive, right? If you compare this to the cost of disk drives and integrating yourselves, yeah, it may be a lot higher, but they're not that expensive, and you're better off getting that kind of support and warranty service and replacement and assistance and all of that that you can get rather than trying to do this yourself, right? One of the questions is, well, I would do it with, you know, enterprise level drives. I wouldn't even do that, right? I would not integrate this myself. I would buy a system that somebody else has already debugged for me.
Now, I mean, I'd be game to go the consumer SSD route or maybe buy the enterprise yourself and do it yourself. If it was like something in test and dev that, you know, it doesn't matter so much when it goes down, but when it's business critical stuff, you don't want to be farting around. No, don't mess about.
You know, Nigel, I've spent some time in the past talking with Chris Evans about this kind of stuff too. And, you know, Chris is a storage guy that we both know and love. And, he's really of the same opinion also. Why on earth would you ever want to build a mission critical thing yourself? When you can actually buy solutions that are not that expensive, that come with full warranty and support from the vendor and, you know, people that can help you do it, right? That have, you know, failure alerts built in. So, you know, if something is going wrong, you might not know that, but the vendor does because these things call home. It's insane to build this stuff yourself.
Okay. Well, I think that probably wraps us up for this week then, Mark. A lot of good content there. Hope everybody enjoyed listening, and we'll be back again next week. Same time, same place.